Phil Picardi here with the MPR News Update podcast. Here's Minnesota's news on your schedule. The Minnesota State Patrol says former Senate staffer Michael Brodkorb was seriously injured in a one-car crash in Mendota Heights last night. Brant Williams reports.
State Patrol spokesman Lieutenant Eric Roski says Brodkorb's Subaru was heading northbound on 35E near Highway 13 when it went off the right side of the road and hit a bridge abutment. He says the vehicle then traveled back over 35E and crashed into the median. Roski says the road conditions were clear and no one appears to have witnessed the crash.
Troopers did note that Mr. Brodkorb was not wearing a seatbelt at the time of the crash, and they did detect alcohol on his breath.
Roski says Brodkorb was transported to Regents Hospital in critical condition. Brodkorb was an aide to Senate Republicans and filed a discrimination lawsuit last year after he was fired over his affair with then-Senate Majority Leader Amy Koch.
That's Brant Williams, the attorney who represented a former police officer in a data privacy lawsuit, is praising a bill that would impose stiff penalties for improperly accessing the personal information of Minnesota drivers. Larry Fett represented Anne Marie Rasmussen in a lawsuit she filed after discovering her records were improperly accessed hundreds of times by law enforcement officers. Fett says the increased penalties in the legislation could help prevent such incidents.
I'm excited to see that there's some attention being paid to this because we believe from the case that we had with Ms. Rasmussen that this was widespread, pervasive, known to supervisors, and basically blithely ignored. So by putting harsher penalties, I think it does send a message that it's not going to be tolerated anymore.
Fett says as part of the settlement in the lawsuit, the State Department of Public Safety is agreeing to tighter monitoring of its databases. A group of sheriffs and prosecuting attorneys is calling for changes to the state's mental health and criminal justice systems. Madeline Barron says they hope the steps would reduce gun violence.
Hennepin County Sheriff Rich Stanek appeared at the state capitol with state lawmakers, advocates for people with mental illness, law enforcement officers, judges, and prosecutors. Stanek called it the first step in a statewide conversation on mental health and extreme gun violence. He says Minnesota needs to do more to stop gun crimes, like last year's deadly shooting at Accent Signage Systems in Minneapolis. But the sheriff also emphasized that most people with a mental illness are not violent and are no more likely to commit violent crime than anyone else.
Gun control alone is not going to solve the complex problem of guns and extreme violence. We have an access problem, and the severely mentally ill should never have access to guns. Now, having said that, we have an epidemic of untreated mental illness in the United States and right here in Minnesota.
Stanek introduced five proposals that have the backing of the Minnesota Sheriff's Association. He says the state should ensure that courts send information about felony convictions and mental health commitments to the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension within 24 hours. The BCA already adds that information electronically to the National Instant Criminal Background Check System. That federal database keeps records on people who may be disqualified from owning or buying firearms. Carver County Sheriff Jim Olson, who helped introduce the proposals today, says the federal database is incomplete. He says some civil commitment records are missing.
We need to ensure that all of these records, both moving forward as well as reaching back, are included into this system. Never, and I mean never, should a person who has been deemed mentally ill and dangerous by the courts be allowed to purchase a handgun.
Stanek also says law enforcement officers need to have immediate access to mental health court records. Although the court records are already public, Stanek says many officers do not have that information when responding to 911 calls. Hennepin County Judge Jay Quam outlined another proposal that has the backing of the Sheriff's Association, providing more prompt mental health evaluations of jail inmates. Quam says right now, many people with mental illness languish in jail for months without treatment.
Jail is a very bad place to bring people who are living with untreated mental illness. It challenges the strength and stability of even the most healthy people, and it's especially destructive, sometimes irreversibly so.
Quam says more immediate psychiatric evaluations would allow judges to make quick decisions about whether to send inmates elsewhere for treatment.
The way the system is now, it's a cumbersome, time-consuming, and expensive system. It typically takes 2 to 3 to 4 months until the person finally comes through and gets the treatment that they need. it wouldn't be that difficult to consolidate the proceedings. So rather than having someone sit for 3 or 4 months, they can be done with their proceedings within 1 to 2, maybe 3 weeks in most cases.
Stanek and others also called for a review of the state's civil commitment law and an assessment of available resources to treat mental illness in Minnesota. Sue Abderholden, the executive director of the Minnesota Office of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, appeared with Stanek at today's news conference, but says she doesn't agree with all of his proposals. She says there's no need to change the civil commitment law right now.
I think you could find a group of people who would say the interpretation is too loose and a group of people who would say the interpretation is too tight. I also think that if you don't have community-based services, if you don't have anywhere for people to go, frankly, it doesn't matter.
Stanek says he took the disagreement as a positive sign that people are willing to start talking openly and honestly about mental health and gun violence. He says he plans to share the proposals with Governor Dayton.
Madeline Barron there, now Conrad Wilson. He says murder prosecutions of people who provide controlled substances that cause another person's death hit a 10-year high last year.
Law enforcement officials say the increase in third-degree murder cases is linked in part to the explosion in opiate-based drug abuse. In 2010, Todd Kosovich, an assistant Morrison County attorney, charged and later convicted a woman with third-degree murder for selling the prescription drug fentanyl. The person she sold it to overdosed and died.
When you start crossing to people dying, and often suddenly, and unfortunately often young people, that kind of just rings a bell in your head that we've got to do something different. We've got to drag out every law we can.
While the increase in third-degree murder charges isn't a coordinated effort to reduce overdose deaths, law enforcement officials say they hope it saves lives. Conrad Wilson, Minnesota Public Radio News, Little Falls.
Hundreds gathered last night at Washburn High School in Minneapolis. They talked about how to move forward from what many perceive to be a racial incident. 2 weeks ago, 4 students wrapped string around the neck of a dark-skinned doll and hung it in a stairwell. Tim Post was at last night's meeting.
Washburn's principal, Carol Markham Cousins, told the crowd of nearly 400 people gathered in her school's auditorium that, like many of them, she was shocked by the incident.
I was incensed, outraged, embarrassed, humiliated, and angry that this would happen at our diverse and rich school.
Markham Cousins has been criticized by some parents because she didn't publicly comment on the incident until 5 days after it happened. She apologized for the delay. She says the school and the district are committed to tackling the issue.
Because we are going to face this. It's racist. And it's wrong.
Audience members were invited to take to the microphones and share how the incident affected them. Dozens did just that during the emotional, yet civil, 2-hour meeting. A student named Sonny, who only offered his first name, said he's found Washburn very welcoming. But as an African-American student, he said the incident has hurt him a lot. He offered this idea on how the school can move on.
I also believe that an apology should be made by the 4 students. And that's my input. Thank you.
It was a similar refrain that came from several other students as well. But many students seem frustrated at the level of outrage the incident has caused. Senior Maggie Kramer reminded the audience that this was all because of the actions of only 4 students in a school of 2,000.
What I'm here to say is that it in no way represents our student body. The Washburn I have experienced is a tightly knit community. We see each other as fellow human beings, different, but human beings nonetheless.
Many Washburn students spoke about how proud they were of their school, to the cheers of the audience. Activist Al Flowers told the crowd that was all well and good, but students should know the incident was painful.
This is not a pep rally. We know you love your school, but we want to know what you know, particularly me as an African American, our history.
Other parents and community members urged Minneapolis school officials to consider teaching more about racial strife in the country's history, so students have a better understanding of why the imagery of a dark-skinned doll hung by the neck is disturbing to so many people. After the meeting, Superintendent Bernadia Johnson told reporters history books often fall short in that area. Johnson said the district may address that by making changes to its curriculum. That will take time, she said, but the meeting had a more immediate purpose.
Our main goal tonight was to bring people together to hear about how they experienced the situation and to start healing. And I think that's really important.
Johnson refused to comment on the punishment the four students at Washburn faced after the incident or to release their names, citing federal and state data privacy laws. Principal Carol Markham Cousins has spoken with all of the students and says they're sorry for what they did.
They're full of remorse. Absolutely.
Markham Cousins says the school will hold more meetings in the near future for students to again voice their opinions on what the school can do to learn from the incident and prevent it from happening again.
That's Tim Post in Minneapolis. Representatives of the hockey, orchestral, and sugar production worlds rubbed shoulders yesterday as they testified about lockouts before a DFL-led Minnesota House committee. Ewan Kerr was there.
Representative Joe Atkins, chair of the House Commerce Committee, said he wanted to hear more about the larger economic impacts of recent lockouts. Representatives of the Minnesota Wild NHL team, the Minnesota Orchestra Management, its locked out musicians, and the locked out musicians of the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra all testified. The committee also heard from business owners who've lost money because of the hockey and orchestra lockouts, and from three community representatives from Moorhead describing the impact of the 18-month-long lockout of 1,300 American Crystal sugar workers. There are no bills on the use of lockouts currently before the House, but Representative Atkins says some are being considered.
That's Ewan Kerr on the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. We now have a pretty clear idea about what President Obama hopes to accomplish during his second term. Climate change, marriage equality, just a couple of the issues he plans to work on. Former White House aide Bill Burton is in Minnesota today, speaking at the University of Minnesota, his alma mater. Republicans, like Republican Senator Mitch McConnell, criticized Obama's second inaugural speech this week, saying it's clear he plans to steer the ship of state far left of center. Kathy Werzer talked about that with Bill Burton during Morning Edition.
Senator John Thune of South Dakota said about the speech, "We were reminded that this is a liberal president with a liberal agenda." How is the president's approach different from old-style Democratic policies?
Well, I think that what people need to remember is that the president did just win an election. And on these issues that he spoke about in the inaugural address, he's much closer to where the American people are than where Mitch McConnell and John Boehner are. And they've got a choice. They can either say, we're going to work with the president on these important issues, or we're going to continue to just play politics and try to oppose every single thing he does, regardless of where the American people are, because that's better for our politics.
Your talk today is about the direction the president's taking the country. You call it pragmatic progressivism. What do you mean by that?
One hallmark of this presidency is that if you look at the first term, he's been able to even make big accomplishments on issues where the public might not be with him in the beginning, like the auto bailout, but get to a place where the public supports it, it's successful, and people are glad that we did it.
You know, given that you've spent a lot of time in Washington, I'm wondering, with partisan politics, what can really get done in Congress in the next few months around issues like the debt and entitlement spending and climate change, that kind of thing?
Well, we're at a point where we're at a crisis on the debt. And on immigration, we're in a specific moment where we can actually get something done, because not only is there a policy problem, but Republicans, I think, have started to realize that they also have a big political problem. So if we don't get something done on immigration, then shame on us, because this is the exact sort of moment where that could happen. When it comes to climate, I don't know. Republicans haven't seemed willing to do anything on climate. And I think in the future, people will look back at this time and not have very kind things to say about people who are climate deniers. So the president may just have to act, do everything he can by executive authority to get things done. But when it comes to the debt and entitlement reform, you know, something really needs to get done. And Republicans are either going to come to the table or they're going to continue to obstruct.
So I have to ask you something else. It's possible an announcement could be made soon on the president's next chief of staff, and one of the front runners appears to be a Minnesota native, Dennis McDonough, a guy you worked with in the White House. Why is Dennis a good choice for the job?
Dennis is one of the absolute great advisors the president has around him. He is such a great standard bearer for the state of Minnesota in the White House. He's talented. He works hard. He knows the president. He knows the He knows the policies, both national security and domestic. And he's the kind of guy who you would want on your side, you know, in a policy fight, in a knife fight, in any kind of fight that you're going to have. So he is really a great choice for the president. And hopefully he does name him soon. I ran into him the other night, and I told him that I hope that he figures out a way to squeeze some sleep into his new life, because he's also a terrific dad of beautiful kids, and you know, this is going to be a heck of a couple of years for him.
Do you think Dennis McDonough will get the job?
I sure hope he does, but I think the good money is that he will.
That's former White House aide Bill Burton and Kathy Werzer. The Department of Natural Resources has cut the number of bears controversial researcher Lynn Rogers can collar near his research station outside of Ely. Here's Dan Crocker to tell us why.
The new DNR research permit issued in late December reduces the number of GPS tracking collars Rogers can place on bears from 15 to 12. The new permit also expires in July rather than December. DNR Wildlife Research Manager Lou Cornicelli says Rogers needs to publish more peer-reviewed studies with the data he's collecting.
We don't feel he needs that many bears with radio collars on. I think with the length of time the permit's been out there, there should be some science coming out of this.
Rogers calls the change devastating. He says he's authored 3 peer-reviewed articles in the past 6 years. The DNR argues those were not based on recent data. The DNR and Rogers have been at odds for years, largely over Rogers' practice of hand-feeding bears. The agency says it's getting complaints from people encountering bears who aren't afraid of people.
That's Dan Crocker in northeastern Minnesota. Finally, a curvy, elevated, icy track winds from the St. Paul Cathedral down the hill toward downtown St. Paul. Dozens of ice skaters will descend the track in the second Red Bull Crashed Ice World Championships today through Saturday. Reporter Sasha Aslanian has more.
Crashed ice is a sport made to sell energy drinks. YouTube helmet cam videos show it's fast and out of control. Skaters dressed in hockey gear come out of the starting gate 4 abreast, trying to stay upright while navigating a course loaded with bumps, twists, and drops. We assembled a panel of worriers to analyze the sport. A mom, a doctor, a course designer, and an insurance guy. Rick Lindsay runs X Insurance in Provo, Utah. He's been in the extreme sports insurance business since stuntman Evel Knievel tried to jump the Snake River Canyon on his motorcycle in 1974. But it's hard to sell insurance to people who think they're immortal.
So like Evel Knievel, you know, he didn't want coverage.
Knievel's parachute malfunctioned and he fell strapped into his motorcycle into the river. But he lived. When it comes to assessing risk for the riskiest, insurance man Rick Lindsay says extreme sports keep pushing the envelope.
They're doing backflips on snowmobiles and motocross, and, you know, they're doing these downhill ski events where it's kind of like roller derby. I mean, the things people do today are, you know, far more risky than what we did 20 years ago.
Sports medicine doctor Bill Roberts at the University of Minnesota Medical School drove by the crashed ice course and thought it looked like fun, if he were 25. If he were the doctor on duty, he'd pack a lot of supplies.
I would probably pack some splints for arms and legs, you know, for possible fracture or sprain. I would bring a backboard for a spine injury and a neck brace. I would bring a laceration kit so I could sew up lacerations if somebody got cut, because, you know, the skates are pretty sharp, and if you get hit in the skin, in an open skin area, you could get cut pretty easily. And then probably a kit for taking care of abrasions or scrapes.
The guy who designed the St. Paul Crashed Ice Course is Chris Papillon of Quebec. He's also the first one to try it out.
I'm kind of the crash test dummy.
Papillon has to strike a balance between building an exciting course and one that's safe for riders and spectators, which means raising walls and making tweaks.
We have some accident here and there, but so far nothing special, only thing major happened.
He knocks on his head.
Knock on wood.
Okay. Crashed ice officials say no racers have died, but last year in St. Paul, one skater ended up in the hospital with several leg fractures. Our final worrier is a mom, And not just any mom. Brenda Nas of Lakeville is the mother of 23-year-old Cameron Nas, the top-ranked American in the sport.
You know, the fear factor's there, but we've long gotten over that.
Brenda Nas says she's watched her son play hockey and wakeboard and do extreme sports all his life. And although she first said he was kidding when he emailed her a photo of the crashed ice course last year, she's learned to say, all right, honey, you just go ahead.
When he went down the first time, it was kind of like, all right, you know what, just don't kill yourself. Just make it down and we can be done with this and we can all go home. And when he ended up taking Rookie of the Year and then now moving on this year, you know, I think it's entirely different. You know, I'm confident that he knows what he's doing up there.
Nas says she'll be waiting at the finish line, cheering her son on, hoping he makes it to the next round of crashed ice in the Netherlands. And she's not worried.
That's Sasha Aslanian in St. Paul. I'm Phil Picardi, also in St. Paul, here in the studios of Minnesota Public Radio News. I'm glad that you came along for the ride today. Tomorrow, Friday, Minnesota's news on your schedule from the NPR News Update from Big John Wanamaker.